Jim Fetcher, your host on The Real Deal, is my very special guest today. He's the author of Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. And if that doesn't blow your socks, listen to this. He grew up in Washington, D.C. during the 50s and the 60s. His father was a high-ranking CIA official who was close friends with Richard Helms, James Angleton, and Mary's husband, Cord Meyer. His mother and Mary Meyer were classmates at Vassar, for which I have personal affection because my first serious girlfriend when I was an undergraduate at Princeton went to Vassar. I'll also observe, as no doubt I will discuss with author Peter Janney, that when E. Howard Hunt gave his last confessions to his son, St. John, he included a list of the conspirators that began with LBJ and then went to Cord Meyer, David Attlee Phillips, William Harvey, David Sanchez Morales, and others. I have a great guest today. It's such a pleasure to welcome you to the show, Peter Janney.
Great to be with you, Jim. And you and I also have Princeton University in common.
Oh, tell me, Peter, I was class of 62.
I was class of 1970.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Just 8 years difference. My brother was class of 65.
Uh-huh.
That's fantastic. I love it. Yeah, what was your major?
I was technically a psychology major, but I was very much in love with history, American history.
Yeah, so you took a lot of American history?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Did you go for Bicker? Were you in a club?
Yeah, I ended up in Ivy Club, and then I tried to get out my senior year and join something called Stevenson Hall, and they wouldn't even let me out.
Well, that's very damn interesting. I'll tell you, I believe I was the first person to ever resign from a club after my junior year in Tower Club, which had the, you know, had pioneered bringing in faculty for tutorials and emphasizing.
I remember it well.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah, but my brother had begun my senior year as an undergraduate, and he was working in Commons, and one of my best friends, Pete Tredick, was running Commons, so I actually dropped out of Tower and took my meals at Commons with one of my closest friends and my brother.
That's great.
But listen here, Peter, I am just so impressed by everything I'm reading here, and I want to tell everyone, they've got to go to Amazon.com, check out this book, put in Peter Janney, Mary's Mosaic, and start reading the reviews, because the first two are by Douglas Horn, who was the senior analyst for military records for the Assassination Records Review Board, and by David W. Mantic, MD, PhD. Anyone listening to this show knows how often I have spoken of them. I've interviewed Doug maybe 4 or 5 times, possibly more. I regard them as two of the leading, if not the leading, experts on the assassination of JFK in the world today. And for them to give these rave reviews to Peter's book is really quite extraordinary. Peter, where should we begin?
Well, you know, I guess your audience should know, it's probably best that we begin at the beginning, because I knew Mary Meyer. I knew her family very well. I was best friends with her middle son, Michael Pinchot Meyer, who unfortunately was killed when we were both 9 years old.
And how did that happen?
He was hit by a car. Right at dusk, you know, right around the winter solstice, and you know, it was
first just, time of day for visibility.
Yes, yeah, it was very tragic. And my relationship with Mary, of course, she was a stunning human being. I mean, even as a young boy, I couldn't articulate it, but whenever I was around her, I just felt like there in my midst was a different kind of adult. I mean, she was tender, she was warm, she was endearing. She showed me many times in many different ways how much she cared for me and Michael together. And I just had very, very fond memories of her. And, of course, when Michael was killed, it was really Mary Meyer who was the only adult in my world, even, you know, beyond my parents, who was instrumental in helping me cope with my grief. I continued to go out to the house after Michael's death, and, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night I'd wake up crying, and you know, Mary would console me, and sometimes she would encourage me to talk about Michael and his, you know, leaving my life. And I know it was very painful for her, but there was a real sort of point of contact she and I developed. And, you know, we stayed kind of in touch. And I didn't know about her death, her murder, until I came home the night before Thanksgiving. I was going to boarding school up in New Hampshire, and, of course, a newspaper like a New York Times or a Washington Post was a very rare thing up in New Hampshire then in the early 1960s. And when I came home in the fall of 1964, my mother brought up her murder at the dinner table the night before Thanksgiving. And that night, this is where the book begins. You know, I sort of go through a dark night of the soul, where all these memories come up about Michael, about Mary, and it haunted me, and it stayed with me. And I could never put her murder or her departure to rest. And so that's where the book starts. And then it was in 1976 that all of us first learned through the National Enquirer that Mary had had this affair with President Kennedy for the last 2 to 3 years of his life. And that's when I really started to get very suspicious about what was going on. Various people were calling into contention the Warren Report and contesting it, and you know, really books were coming out showing all the holes in the Warren Report. And it was at that time where this really started to, you know, get under my skin, and I started to get increasingly curious and sort of just very slowly and very methodically began my own investigation.
Well, did you have any realization whatsoever, which seems to me, as his son, it would be difficult to recognize that your father was actually a fairly scary guy?
Well, I bring this up initially in the book, in the prologue, where during the discussion or the revelation that my mother sort of matter-of-factly tells me at the dinner table, you know, where I'm sitting at the dinner table with my father on my right, my mother on my left, my brother across from me. And, of course, my brother was home during that fall, so he knew about it, but I didn't. And so it was really my mother who brought it up, and I had this sort of faint memory of my father just staring off into space, very detached. He didn't say a word. And that image of him stayed with me. And when I came back to the real push to writing this book and really pulling all the pieces of the puzzle together, it was through a series of dreams and my own meditation practice that I began to realize what his specific involvement was in the conspiracy to assassinate Mary Pinchot Meyer.
Yeah, and I was going to say right off the top, I mean, it has to be the case that he was involved in the decision to kill her, and it must be traumatizing to have that realization. I presume your father is long since departed.
He, you know, like a lot of CIA people, he died young. He died addicted to nicotine and alcohol, and he died when he was 59 in the winter of 1979. And, you know, he wasn't, as I portray him in the book, he wasn't a terribly happy person, content person, as he approached his death. I mean, he died very suddenly. He was, you know, playing squash right after lunch with a heart condition, which is not a good thing to do. And I sort of raise the question during that part of the book was, did he just use this as an exit? Because this was at the end of the House Select Service, HSC meeting, where the CIA really almost was on the ropes. They were in huge trouble during this investigation, but they managed to squeak it out. at the end, and I think...
Well, because Robert Blakey, who was in charge, actually wrote the whole thing and directed it against the mafia rather than the CIA, which was a despicable act for which he can never be forgiven.
I couldn't agree with you more. And so, you know, there were, in the wake of the House Select Committee, there were people who were starting to probe a little bit more. And, of course, Seymour Hersh had taken down Jim Angleton. And I think, you know, in the back of my father's mind, he probably felt like it was only going to be a matter of time before someone was going to make some kind of connection and, you know, drag him into this. But, of course, I don't know that for sure. It's just...
Well, needless to say, you know, the CIA devours its own so that it could well have been. He was affected by, you know, something that would have induced a heart attack that would be virtually chemically untraceable. I mean,
anything's possible. You're absolutely right.
Well, I would say, in this case, probable. I mean, it may have been. If he had a bad heart, did you ever see the autopsy report, for example? I mean, if he had a congenital heart problem, that's a rather young age for one to be dying, even playing, you know.
Well, it wasn't a congenital heart problem. It was a heart condition, you know, that he had a series of heart attacks before this event, before the final event. And, of course, he wasn't supposed to continue to smoke, which he was doing.
Yeah.
And he wasn't taking very good care of himself in terms of diet, exercise, that kind of thing. So, yeah, he was headed for disaster. It was only a matter of time.
Well, my father also was a smoker. He didn't drink much, but he also died at 57 in this case after having played a strenuous game of tennis with his closest friend on a Saturday, and then they'd all gone together with their wives to a Mexican restaurant on the way back to the car. His second wife, my stepmother, observed that he was very winded. He'd have to stop and pause, put his hands on his hips, and that night he had a fatal heart attack. She tried to revive him, but was hopeless, and he had turned blue by the time the medics arrived.
Yes.
That was the day I accepted my first position as a professor of philosophy in 1970.
Wow.
Yeah, I never even had the chance to tell him.
Wow.
But, Peter, this is really quite remarkable, and I can certainly appreciate why, you know, having had this personal relationship with Mary, that and her son, that it would make such a profound impact on you, and why you would be driven to get to the bottom of the matter. I mean, this is a kind of undertaking that requires tremendous devotion as well as intelligence and research skills, and is not for the faint-hearted.
Well, you couldn't be more correct about that. You know, it's when I took this project on, Jim, back when I really got serious about doing something on my own about this. This was sort of germinated for me in 2003. Now, Your listeners should know that I had been a friend, a fairly close friend of the late author Leo Damore. And it was Leo Damore who first started the real investigation on the death of Mary Meyer. Damore had published this book, Senatorial Privilege. It was sort of the whole expose of Ted Kennedy at Chappaquiddick, and it became an overnight bestseller for a while, and it did very well. And he'd written a couple of other books before that. He had grown up on Cape Cod. He was worked for the Cape Cod Standard Times. But he, back in the 1970s, had found out a little bit about Mary Meyer, and he became friends with Kenny O'Donnell, who was, as you know, President Kennedy's chief assistant. And he did a big favor for Kenny O'Donnell close to Kenny O'Donnell's death, probably within a year of his death. And Kenny O'Donnell, of course, thanked Leo for what he had done and said, Leo, you know, is there something I could help you with? And Leo said, yes, there is, Kenny. You know, I really want to do a project on Mary Pinchot Meyer, and you, of all people, I think, can share with me what really went on between her and the president. And So Kenny agreed to sit down with Leo, and they had, from what I understand, quite a lengthy interview where O'Donnell basically said that, you know, President Kenny was in love with her and that he planned to leave Jackie after he left office so that he could be with Mary. She was a very important person in the White House during the last 2 years, and she was around all the time. You know, Kenny would say things, you know, like when the president couldn't get in touch with her, he would pace around the office and, you know, worry about where she was and what she was doing. And she became
a genuine devotion to
both families. Yes, and she became a very important person, a very trusted ally to him, I think, to the point where Kenny told Arthur Damore that he really feared the power she had over Jack from time to time, because Jack was just so insistent about wanting to include her in on so many things that had to do with, you know, matters of state as well as his personal life. So this became, you know, I think a very substantial relationship for the president. I don't think, it wasn't that he wasn't having sexual trysts with other women. He was. I think he realized he had a problem in that arena, but he was driven. But I think Mary was smart enough to know that there was something bigger and more important beyond that, and she wasn't really threatened by it. I don't think she liked it, don't get me wrong, but, you know, she wasn't going to, you know, leave him just because, you know, he had a number of, you know, personal problems.
And for her part, I must surmise that Jacqueline Kennedy would have been very much aware of Jack's profound affection and concern and care for Mary. I think it would have been impossible for her not to have discerned that.
Oh, I think she knew for sure. And I present evidence in the book about the fact that she did, and that this was one of the reasons why in the fall of 1963, she just decided to take off with Onassis and go on a cruise on his boat. And according to Onassis's biographer, Peter Evans, this is the time where their relationship was sexually consummated.
She first had sex with Harry, separating herself from Jack, no doubt to make him jealous.
Yeah,
because of her concern about his passionate relationship and feelings for Mary.
Yes. And that's what
all that other stuff is trivial, but this thing with Mary appears to have been really quite significant.
It was, and Peter Evans speaks directly to that as to what the real catalyst was at that particular juncture for both, you know, Jackie and Onassis. I mean, that's really, this was right after their 10th wedding anniversary, and she had it. You know, I think she knew that their marriage, in some sense, was over.
I'm personally convinced she married Onassis to gain the security that the richest man in the world could provide, and that, you may well know, even in their marriage agreement, it specified how often he could have sex with her.
I didn't know that, but that is fascinating.
Yeah. And they were sometimes interrupted. There's a story on his yacht that them having been found in one of the lifeboats having sex.
Uh-huh.
Well, listen, tell me, given this interview, then, he made accessible to you the results of this extraordinary interview with Kenny O'Donnell, and he really wanted you to pursue it because he sensed that he'd be unable to do that.
Well, no, at the time, I don't think that was the case. You know, Leo and I just became natural friends to one another, because Leo was an incredibly thorough researcher and extremely inquisitive. I still have tape recordings of some of our talks together. And so when he found someone like me who knew Mary and knew the family, who could really help him figure some certain things out in Washington and what went on in Washington, he was very interested in talking to me. And so I started visiting with Leo, I think back in February of 1992, and from that time on, right until his, what I call suspicious suicide in October 1995, I mean, he and I, you know, checked in a lot, we talked a lot on the phone, we had periodic visits in person. That's a whole nother story in the book where I come out at the end and say that, you know, I no longer think that Leo's suicide was actually a suicide. As Bill Corson once said to his protege, anyone can commit a murder, but it takes an expert to commit a suicide. And,
yes.
And so I think, as does Leo Damore's attorney, that Leo was actually driven to suicide. I think he may have been poisoned. I think he may have been given some kind of neurotoxin that the CIA had developed that they knew was capable of doing that.
Well, yeah, bear in mind, I mean, it's one of the areas of expertise, as you well know, for the CIA is to murder people and make it look like a suicide or make it look like a natural crime. I mean, that's what they do.
Yes.
That may be what they do best. Unfortunately, they frequently select the wrong targets, just as the assassination of JFK has had the most damaging consequences for the history of the United States and indeed the world ever since.
I could not agree with you more.
Peter, this is utterly fascinating. I'm incredibly glad to have you here. And I'm going to make it no secret that I believe everyone listening to the show should obtain a copy of your book. It appears to me that it is among the most important published on the assassination. And I'm eagerly looking forward to reading it already myself. Tell me, what was the first major development then after Leo's death?
Well, you know, after Leo's death, there was an interest by John H. Davis, the Kennedy assassination researcher. He was very interested in picking up what Leo Damore had done, and he knew Leo's attorney. His name is James H. Smith. He's still alive, very much so, lives down in Falmouth, Massachusetts. And so Davis went to Jimmy Smith to help him, you know, make the right connections, and he got a hold of Leo's research assistant and began to, you know, pick up where Leo had left off. Now, the big thing that Leo was able to do, well, he was able to do a number of incredible things in terms of his research. But Leo figured out who Mary's assassin actually was. And this guy, his name, his alias name was William L. Mitchell. And he was a runner, a jogger on the towpath, allegedly, the day Mary was murdered. And so Mitchell shows up the day after the murder, and he goes to police, and he said, you know, I think I ran by this woman yesterday. And of course, it's already in the papers of the murder. It's a big spread. And of course, Mitchell's first job was to reinforce the idea that this guy, Ray Crump, a sort of downtrodden black Afro-American laborer who the police had arrested because he was in the vicinity of the crime scene about 40 minutes later, that, you know, he was, in fact, the murderer. So Mitchell tells police, oh, yeah, I saw a guy who looked just like this following Mary about 15 minutes before the murder happened, and I ran by Mary, and I ran by him. And, of course, this made the police feel like they'd solved the case. You know, here was this upstanding Army lieutenant who was stationed at the Pentagon. Again, this was CIA cover. They thought they had an open and shut case. And so Mitchell testifies at the trial, trying to very cagely, you know, point out that Ray Crump is the guilty person.
Peter, let's take our first break here. This is a perfect place to do it. This is Jim Fester, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Peter Janney, the author of Mary's Mosaic, a book you don't want to miss. We'll be right back. So your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Peter Janney, the author of Mary's Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace. You gotta get this book. And when some of you listen to me give this enthusiastic endorsement about this book, even though I have yet to read it, let me tell you, when you are as deeply buried into JFK research as am I, when you know what others whom you know inside and out, like Doug Horne and David W. Mantic, have said about this book, when you read what it, how it describes and how it fits into the big picture, I tell you, I have absolutely no doubt that this is a huge book, very important, and I'll tell you why, especially why, it's going to be so big as we round the corner to the 50th observance next year, and that is, it's taking an oblique attack. It's approaching it from a different angle. It's not just talking about ballistics, medical evidence, the faking of the Zapruder film. It's talking about a personal relationship between a man most of us adored and everyone respected, some feared and others loathed, with a unique angle here by a person in a very privileged position to address it. I say this is going to prove to be one of the biggest books of the year as we approach the assassination. And Peter, I'm just so very, very pleased to have you here.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be with you.
So you were talking about, let's see, at the trial, that the effort was this Mitchell, who actually appears to have been the killer, was trying to implicate this poor black guy, who really was an innocent, and it, of course, is revealing, you know, I mean, the CIA really doesn't care about people's lives. The CIA cares about accomplishing its mission, and whether or not its mission has anything to do with the best interests of the American people or principles of ethics or morality or even, you know, law, it has nothing to do with it. I mean, absolutely nothing. Zilch, zero, nada.
Well, there's a little sub-story around the trial, because who should appear at this point in the story but an Afro-American woman who became a legendary attorney in Washington, D.C. Her name was Dovie Roundtree, and there's already been a book written about her by author Katie McCabe. It's an incredibly well-written book. I mean, your listeners would enjoy that as well. And she was really one of the vanguard civil rights attorneys in the 1950s and 1960s. And so she defended Ray Crump for $1.50. She took on a number of indigent clients, but when a fellow preacher, because Mrs. Roundtree was also a pastor, approached her and asked her whether she would be willing to talk to the mother of Ray Crump, she consented. And she'd been following the papers, and, you know, she thought, like a lot of people, it was kind of an open and shut case. But when she went to the first interview to interview her client, she was just flabbergasted, because he was just such a little slip of a man. He was incapable of pulling off anything like this. And she decided that the pursuit of justice was so incredibly important that she was going to take on this case and, you know, get this guy acquitted, because she was convinced, she staked her entire professional reputation on this case, actually, and considerable financial resources that came out of her own pocket to defend this guy. And so in the book, there's a very long chapter on the trial, and it is just, people have told me that that chapter alone was worth reading in the book, because it is just such a tour de force of how she takes apart the prosecution's case piece by piece by piece, to the point at the end of the trial, it's just so clear that this guy, Ray Crump, could not have committed this murder. There was not a shred of forensic evidence linking this man to the crime scene or to Mary Pinchot Meyer's body, and as well as a number of other inconsistencies that she was able to, you know, manifest during the trial. And it's just it sets the stage. That's the end of part one of the book. The reader leaves that part saying, well, it's pretty clear that this guy, Ray Crump, could never have killed this woman. So who did?
Well, it's also fascinating that here you have the apparent actual killer as a witness in the trial, and I'm fascinated what Roundtree did with him in terms of, you know, cross-examination.
Well, that's a very good point, because she was always suspicious of who this guy William Mitchell was. He would never return her phone calls. She could never get a hold of him to interview him before the trial took place. And so I have these tape recordings of the author Leo DeMore interviewing W. Roundtree, where they start talking about this guy Mitchell. And DeMore is already on this guy's case. I mean, he already suspects that there's something very, very fishy about this. But DeMore, we come into the end of 1992. He's supposed to turn in some kind of manuscript. He doesn't have it done because he cannot locate this guy, William Mitchell. But meanwhile, he's been able to talk to another former CIA analyst who tells him that Mitchell's address was a known CIA safe house. So what DeMore does is he finally goes to Fletcher Prouty, and he, you know, talks to Fletcher Prouty, and he asks for Prouty's help. And it's Prouty who outs Mitchell, who tells DeMore, when he learns about the case and what went down, what a carbon copy of a case it was to the JFK assassination itself. And so DeMore writes a letter to this guy Mitchell and sends it to his old address, thinking that, you know, I don't know what was in the letter, but he must have said something to the point of, look, I know who you are. We can do this the hard way or the easiest way, but unless you're willing to talk to me, you know, I'm gonna go public with what I know, and at some point, you know, they're gonna come after you. So 3 months later, at the end of March of 1993, DeMore's telephone rings late at night, and it's Mitchell, or someone who identifies himself as Mitchell. And they proceed to have a several hour long telephone conversation, which DeMore tapes. And Mitchell confesses to DeMore, on the basis of what I think was in that letter, that he does not want to be the fall guy for this, but it was a CIA operation. He was the assassin. It was a whole team approach. Mary had been under surveillance right after the Warren Commission came out. And so at some point, they end the conversation, and DeMore calls his attorney later that morning. It's probably 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when the phone call ends. At 8:30, Leo calls his attorney, Jimmy Smith. And Jimmy, who sits at his desk, as most lawyers does, pulls out his yellow pad and just starts taking notes on the call. And he took 6 pages of notes, which he meticulously saved. And when I found Jimmy Smith back in 2003, he gave me the notes to this telephone call, which are part of the appendix in the back of my book. And it was during that call that Leo explains to him what he's found out, that he's finally found Mary's true assassin, that Leo had also come into a copy of Mary Meyer's real diary, which says a number of things about the assassination, and the fact that she was so outraged by the Warren Commission report that she had decided that she was going to go public. She was going to come out. She was going to tell the world who she was. Of course, she's already a very well-known figure in Washington, a very educated, respected woman who comes from a well-to-do family. And, of course, she's ready to come out and say, look, I was President Kennedy's lover, and I know what happened here, and I think the CIA was behind this assassination. And that's basically the reason why they decided they had to eliminate her.
And I take it a close friend of hers, too, died shortly thereafter. I'm thinking of Dorothy Kilgallen in that case.
I don't know if they knew each other.
My mistake, Peter. I was thinking about Dorothy Kilgallen, who, you know, was threatening to blow the case open after her one-on-one interview with Jack Ruby.
That's right.
And where she died of a barbiturate overdose that, while she used them, she would never have administered to herself. All her research materials were taken. And a close personal friend in whom she would have been expected to have confided died shortly after she did. Both appear to have been cleanup operations like this one on Mary.
I think that's very probable.
I'm astonished that the diary survived such that Leo could have come into possession of a copy of it. That just shocks me.
Well, the way that Leo got a copy of it is that Angleton gave a copy of the diary to this guy, Bernie Yeo, who ran this organization in Washington called AIM, Accuracy in Media. And
yeah.
It was sort of the forerunner to Fox News. It was a right-wing conservative news organization. And
it was basically a disinformation office.
Exactly.
You know, they had the brilliant choice of the title. You know, they're supposed to uphold inaccuracy when they're actually promoting falsehood.
Right. And so, you know, when Angleton was taking a beating in the press, you know, AIM came out in support of him. And, of course, Angleton was very thankful to this guy, Bernie Yeo. And I go into it in the book where, you know, Angleton wanted to show his thanks and what a great guy he was. And he comes to Yeo and he said, look, I want to show you something. I've got the diary of Mary Meyer. And Yeo goes, who's she? And he said, you know, the woman who was killed on the turf, on the towpath. I took care of everything. And so this is what Bernie Yeo tells Leo DeMore. And it's, I think, how Leo came into getting a copy of the diary. Because he got it from Yeo. But, of course, Leo's copy of the diary and the tapes of his phone call disappear after Leo's suicide, and I could never find them. And I talked to his wife, and I went to his apartment, and, you know, the spaces.
Right.
I didn't know whether he
that's
cared.
That's part and parcel of the cleanup office.
I mean, yeah, I think you're right.
And Mary, too. You know, the miracle is that her diary should have survived at all. It simply astonishes me.
Well, you know, Angleton stole the diary either out of Mary's painting studio the night of the murder or out of her bedroom on the night of the murder. And
sure.
So Angleton never destroyed anything. That I was able to substantiate. He had a number of safes at CIA that they had to open with blowtorches to get the
copies
after he left. But, of course, a number of Angleton's most precious documents were secretly squirreled out of the agency by Bob Crowley and a couple of other people who conspired to do this. And it was Crowley who had all this, had a lot of Angleton's material. And, of course, there was a big game he was playing with the author Joe Trento as to how much of it he was going to share with him.
And, of course, as we both know, Angleton and Crowley feature in a book called Regicide by one Gregory Douglas, who has been viewed as a possible disinformation operative. I had myself a number of exchanges with Gregory that we can discuss, but what's most interesting to me about Gregory's book, which I review in Assassination Research, Volume 2, Number 1, and give a preface about my relationship with Gregory Douglas, is that Gregory recounts in the text of his book about how Angleton had suspected that there was something going on between JFK and Khrushchev, and that he had a certain document that were given to highest members of the administration, but that they were slightly different, so he could determine if such a document showed up in the hands of Nikita Khrushchev, who had been the source, and it turned out that the document did show up and that JFK had been the source, which led Angleton to believe, albeit falsely, that Jack was betraying the country. In fact, both he and Khrushchev were in the awkward position of being unable to trust their own highest-ranking military officers. I mean, both of them were, you know, adamantly committed to destroying the enemy, and Jack and Nikita were trying to figure out a way to achieve world peace, And what gave away that was something funny about the book was that it includes an English, what's alleged to be an English translation of a Russian summary of the assassination. And Peter, this summary claims that there were three shots and only three shots. Well, this is fired. Well, this is simply absurd. If the Russians had done their own independent investigation, they would have discovered, you know, 8, 9, or 10 shots had been fired. JFK himself had been hit 4 different times. Connally had been hit multiple times, other shots missed. So I knew upon reflection that something was wrong with the book. And then it belatedly occurred to me that if this is just like the sting operation involving Dan Rather, when he reported on George W. Bush fitness report, Dan Rather had gone over that fitness report with a CO who had actually written it, the secretary who had actually typed it. He knew it was verbatim accurate and very damaging to Bush. But Bush's own operatives, Karen Hughes and Carl Rove, apparently, had figured out that the way to destroy the story was to have it retyped on a slightly newer font, typewriter font for a selectory that didn't exist at the time, so that anyone would infer that if the document is fake, therefore the content must be false, which, of course, is a colossal blunder.
Right.
And I say, in this case, with the Russian document, you know that that is fraudulent. And therefore you infer, well, maybe the whole story is fake, but actually, Peter, as I surmise you also believe, I think that what he was telling us about Angleton and JFK was all accurate, and that it was the use of the Russian report in translation in this beautiful English. I mean, the idea that this could have been originally Russian and then translated into English is preposterous. Was a, you know, another very clever deceit where they're getting truthful information out but making it appear as though it were all a ruse.
Yes, I completely concur with that, and I know exactly the story that you're talking about. There was also another document in that book called the Operation Zipper document, which I think was a list of sort of meetings, telephone calls, that had to do with some of the logistics and planning. And it was this document that Crowley himself put together. And as Douglas told me, it was his personal insurance policy. In other words, should something happen and, you know, the truth started to come out, Crowley was not going to take the rap alone. If he was going to go down, he was going to take the entire upper echelon of the CIA with him. So, you know, he was the one that created this document, and he gave a copy of it to Bill Corson, who kept it in his safety deposit box. And I bring this up in my book in such a way to corroborate this part of the Gregory Douglas caper, because there are some things about Gregory Douglas that are not on the up and up. And I make a point of interviewing a number of other witnesses to the fact that Douglas and Crowley had this relationship, including Crowley's wife, Emily Crowley, who verified it, and Tom Kimmel, who's the grandson of Admiral Husband Kimmel, who knew Crowley and Corson very, very well. And so there are some dimensions of the Gregory Douglas story that I do think are quite accurate. We'll never know completely sure unless Gregory Douglas decides to come up with some of these tape recordings that he had.
Well, I had conversation with Gregory Douglas. I was so fascinated by this. I mean, it's the only case where I wound up reversing my opinion of a book. I initially was so impressed, I gave it a 5-star rating. And after I figured out this business about the Russian, I reverted to a 1, but, you know, it probably belongs in the middle. Somebody recently read what I had to say about him and said he thought I'd been too severe in going from 5 to 1, and he's probably right. I should have put it at a 3, because it has some very positive things here we're discussing, but also some very misleading, this Russian business, ridiculous. But your point about the Zipper, the Crowley, you know, angles and all that seems to me completely fascinating and very probably true. I'm inclined to think that was all true. So to resolve some of my doubts about Gregory, I tried to arrange for us to have dinner. We were actually going to have dinner, I think, at Bob Chin's, you know, fish fish place in Chicago. It's no longer there, but at the time it was a wonderful place to dine. And Gregory didn't show up. And, you know, I mean, that spoke to me volumes that something really was wrong here, because I really wanted to get an assessment. I'd even arranged for a friend who I consider to be very discerning to join us. And as I recall, he was even going to bring someone with him, too, but it never came to pass.
Well, he's a very, speaking as a clinical psychologist, which I am, you know, I mean, Gregory Douglass has a certain kind of personality structure that I think takes him into fantasy land and a certain amount of paranoia. And I don't say that to disparage him. It's just, you know, I have to be as astute as I possibly can in terms of understanding who I'm dealing with. But I think, you know, as we've already decided, I do think that there is some fairly good evidence here that we just, you know, can't dismiss.
Yes.
Because, you know, he's been wrong about other things, or he hasn't told the truth about this or that. You know, we're all a mixed bag. Human behavior is sometimes very complex.
Yes.
And of course, we always have to do our best to substantiate our sources.
And everyone must appreciate, as Marty Schatz observed in his book, History Will Not Absolve Us, that the objective of disinformation is not to convince you of one side or the other, but to leave everything up in the air so that anything is believable and nothing is known.
Right.
And I think your background as a clinical psychologist put you in an excellent position to be pursuing these issues, Peter. I just think this is so incredibly fortuitous that you should have been born of the father of whom you were born, who was in the position he was in, that you should have actually known, had personal contact with some of the key players, like Richard Helms, for example, and James Angleton. I mean, not to mention Mary's husband, Cord Meyer. I mean, you actually knew these people. And then to have had this personal, very affecting relationship with Mary herself, I just stunned that all these circumstances came together to put you in exactly the right position. I mean, listen, you know, Jim Mars, whom many of us recognize as a leading expert on the assassination, wrote of your book, Mary's Mosaic Just Might Have Solved a Great Murder Mystery. This is a must read, and that is my opinion, too, and I'm so looking forward to reading it.
Well, I truly don't think you'll be disappointed, Jim. I think you'll find it a very compelling read. And, you know, I spent years writing it. I mean, this was possibly the most challenging, you know, one of the most challenging things I've ever attempted in my life. And were it not for a first-class education that I had, I don't think I would have been able to pull it off. I mean, as you know, at a place like Princeton, you really learn about what rigorous scholarship is all about and what you have to strive for, particularly when you're trying to do historical research. And I was very fortunate that I had a wonderful advisor in the historian Martin Duberman there, who just, you know, gave me incredible tutorials about history and historians and, you know, the pursuit of history and what it meant. So,
Princeton was so fantastic, just as I did my undergraduate thesis for Carl G. Hempel, who was the most influential philosopher of science in the world at the time. I mean, it was a marvelous place. But when I graduated, Peter, it was ranked number one in the world in physics, philosophy, and mathematics.
Yes.
We're going to take our second break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Peter Janney, author of Mary's Mosaic. You don't want to miss what's coming up. We'll be at Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Peter Janney, author of Mary's Mosaic, the CIA's conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyers, and their vision for world peace. Peter, we got to go from the trial to how you were able to sort this out. I mean, obviously you had a huge lead because of this phone call that Mitchell made, to which you had informational access, at least by way of the notes of Leo's attorney. So please carry us forward from that point.
Well, what happens in part two of the book, Jim, is really I start to do more of a biographical sketch of who Mary Pinchelmeyer is. And I sort of pick up her life as she's going through Vassar College and what happens afterwards. And then I start to get into her life with Cord Meyer and how that fell apart and the death of her son, Michael, and then, you know, her separation and divorce from Cord, all of which, you know, she engineered. I mean, she was the instigator of ending the marriage and getting out. Now, your readers should know that Mary and Jack Kennedy first met each other when she was 15 years old and he had just graduated from the Choate School in Wallingford, Connecticut. And this was at a dance at the Choate School, the Choate Winter Festivities Weekend in February of 1936. And JFK is at that time a freshman at Princeton, but he's been sick and he's had to spend a lot of time in the hospital. And to sort of get his feet back under him socially, he decides to come back to Choate, from which he's already graduated from, and he comes back to the Winter Festivities dance as a stag. And this is the first time that he lays eyes on Mary. And Mary happens to be Ambassador Bill Atwood's date, who was a couple of years behind JFK at Choate. So JFK starts cutting in on Atwood, and Atwood is sick. He has to run upstairs and gargle with Listerine a couple of times, and of course that means leaving Mary unattended, and you know, Jack pursues her. But this is when Jack and Mary met, but it didn't really gel at that time. I think she kind of saw through Jack, you know, in terms of being the kind of playboy that he was, and she really hungered for a relationship. There was something a little bit deeper and a little more dynamic, but they were in each other's radar screen that early in their life. And of course, when Mary and Cord Meyer show up at the UN conference in 1945, who should also be there but Jack Kennedy, who's working for the Hearst newspaper chain, writing stories. And Jack and Cord get into a little fight over Mary. You know, I mean, you know, JFK wants to be included in the social scene, and Cord doesn't want to have anything to do with him. So there are a few testosterone sparks that fly at that point. But again, you know, both Cord Meyer and Jack Kennedy were two emerging stars in post-World War II America. And people really don't know that much about Cord. I devote an entire chapter to him in the book, where it was really Cord Meyer who was looked at as possible presidential material. I mean, he came back from World War II, a wounded veteran, and he became very disenchanted with the province of war. He became a real peacenik after the war, and he was part of this movement called the United World Federalists, and he spent a couple of years just working his tail off, going around the country, speaking to people, speaking at colleges, saying that we have to have an organization like the UN, but something much stronger that can keep world peace. But of course, with the emergence of the Cold War, it doesn't happen. And Cord gets very disenchanted, gets very upset, goes back to Harvard for a while, and then gets seduced by Alan Dulles. And, you know, Alan Dulles says, you know, come
on. We're talking literally.
Exactly. And so Cord goes to work for the CIA in the early 1950s and is just a rising star there. I mean, Cord is a very dynamic person. He is a brilliant writer. He could do almost anything and do it well. but he gives up all of his, you know, world peace ideas, and of course is now engaged in the Cold War with the Russians over who gets to dominate and whose empire who is going to beat out the other.
And this was roughly the insidious influence of Alan Dulles and others at the agency who were inducing him to see the world as a darker, more threatening place, roughly.
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
well,
you know,
Dulles had seduced Mary, but it didn't continue. It was just a brief liaison.
Well, Mary hated Dulles from the very beginning. As she said to one person, she compared him to Machiavelli, only worse. And so she was not having the wool pulled over her eyes by him. She wasn't taking the bait at all. Of course, Angleton, Helms, Cordwright.
Well, did you mean to imply that they had a brief-lived affair?
Oh, no.
Okay. That's what I wanted to get clear about.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply that at all.
My misunderstanding. Go ahead.
No. And so, you know, Mary emerges out from her marriage, and, you know, she's an artist. She's a painter. She's a very independent woman, very self-assured. She's got enough of her own money to take care of herself. And she's very attracted to the artistic avant-garde. And, of course, what's happening with the avant-garde is hallucinogens, LSD and psilocybin. And she wants to do it, and she does. And she gets very attracted to what the power of these drugs are and the kind of consciousness that they can induce in terms of helping people get beyond the sort of love, hate, good, evil kind of polarity and to the understanding that you know, armed conflict isn't going to solve anything, that what's really important is living in harmony with the rest of life, living in peace, promoting peace, and she believes that these experiences are exactly the kind of thing that world leaders around the globe should be having. Were they to have them, there wouldn't be a Cold War as far
because
as...
Because their consciousness expanding.
Exactly. I mean, you know, just see beyond this very quickly. So that has a major impact on Mary. And when she starts to rekindle, or in a sense, kindle for the first time, her relationship with Jack, which, by the way, started right after he was elected president, even before he moved into the White House, is when their, according to Kenny O'Donnell, is when their affair really started to begin.
How did they reconnect here?
Well, one of the ways that they reconnected is that... Kennedy showed up at a cocktail party at the Bradleys, of which Mary was at. And
I wanted to ask you, yes, about Ben Bradley, who's an important player here. Yes.
And this was in 1959. And apparently there were some sparks that started to take place at that cocktail party. And that summer, they secretly met up in Provincetown, Massachusetts for just a couple of days. And what I... from this one source who gave this information to Leo DeMore, a very reliable source, Jack was miserable. He had realized at that point that his life with Jackie was not what he wanted. He was very ambivalent about politics, and he came to Mary, and he was, you know, almost distraught in terms of how unhappy he was. And she basically said, look, you know, if you're really serious about becoming president, you've got to pull it together. I'm not going to get involved with you. That would be sabotage. You're a fool if you continue to fool around like this. And he says in so many words, I'm not sure I can help myself. But, you know, she bids him support, you know, and they, I think, maintain some kind of connection, but it's not intimate. It doesn't really start to get intimate until the actual very beginning of his presence.
But she's starting to serve as an advisor, as somebody who can actually give him counseling to understand where he is in his alternatives in life and what he needs to do if he's going to maximize his potential.
Exactly. And Jack, I think, sees in Mary the kind of woman that he saw in his sister, Kathleen. Jack's relationship with his oldest sister, Kathleen, was a very important relationship for him. It's one of the few relationships that he had as a young man with a woman where he really respected his sister. He liked her. He was never disparaging of her. He treated her as an equal. So when she's killed in a plane crash in the late 1940s, he is just absolutely devastated. It was a very bad time for him at that point, and I think it really affected him badly. But his rekindling with his relationship with Mary, I think, starts to awaken him again, the possibility of, you know, some sort of redemption in his troubled, intimate life with women.
Fascinating. Yes. And, of course, when she met him there in Georgetown, he was a much older, more mature, you know, handsome, debonair, but more substantial person than when they had met at Choate.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there was a huge transformation.
That's right. He's already... I think he married Jackie in 53, if my memory serves me correctly. And, of course, his marriage to Jackie, for all intents and purposes, it was an arranged marriage. I mean, this was his father's choice. It wasn't Jack's choice. And this was all in the service of him becoming the perfect picture of a political couple, you know, that could ascend the throne of American politics. And Jackie is sort of, you know, the sort of prototypical looking woman who will eventually, you know, take the throne as queen. But it was not what we would call a happy marriage. It was not, you know, a partnership. It was not a relationship of equals like he had with Mary, or like he approached with Mary Meyer.
I'm certainly willing to believe that. We do have a magnificent photographic archive of wonderful moments between Jack and Jackie and John and Caroline that I think have, affected virtually every American who cared about John F. Kennedy. So I do believe there was a lot of very genuine emotion there. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that Jackie loved Jack quite profoundly. And notwithstanding everything related to Aristotle Onassis, it was really quite evident in the immediate aftermath of the assassination that she had a profound love for him.
Let's face it. I mean, human behavior is very, very complex. There's nothing black and white here. And, of course, they shared, you know, not only two children, but a couple of miscarriages together. You know, it wasn't as if they were strangers of ships passing in the night. It just wasn't the kind of relationship where, you know, they were a team like he was with Mary Meyer.
Families with their background and wealth were actually much more permissive about indulgences, affairs, and that sort of thing, which generally were not allowed to rock the boat, but were broadly tolerated.
Right. You know, I think when you compare the relationships, you know, with Mary Meyer, there was, for lack of a better term, there was kind of this sort of soulmate connection between President Kennedy and Mary Meyer.
Yeah.
And had they both lived, I think there's a very strong chance that they would have ended up together. And that they would have really committed to one another, and that Jack really would have gone through some real redemptive experiences in terms of having a healing impact on his promiscuity.
Tell us more about the 2 years in which they were involved while Jack was in the White House and where her presence was ubiquitous.
Well, you know, this comes from Nina Burley's interview with White House counsel Meyer Feldman, which was actually one of the better parts of Nina Burley's book. Nina Burley wrote the first published book on Mary Meyer called A Very Private Woman. It was published in 1998. And she's got some other particularly good research that I mentioned in there, although I think she misses quite a bit. But this interview that she did with Meyer Feldman, he was just very clear that, you know, as he said, Mary Meyer was part of the furniture in the White House. I mean, she was always there. She was in a lot of cabinet meetings. She was in the White House residence. Feldman said that he just saw her all the time, that it was very clear that JFK had a lot of respect for her opinion and consulted her on a number of things and wanted to know how she felt about this. And even Arthur Schlesinger, you know, when they're looking for a historian to write about the Bay of Pigs, this guy, I think his name is Trumbull, Schlesinger writes a memo and said, well, I can recommend this guy Trumbull, he's a historian, but Mary Meyer knows him better than I do, you know, so you should check with her about it. I mean, it's clear that Mary has a certain kind of status within the inner sanctum of Kennedy's administration, and of course, Kenny O'Donnell confirms that to the point where sometimes, you know, he was even afraid of her because of the power that she could have.
Doug Horne, in his review of your book on Amazon.com, observes how there are many revelations here about the Cold War culture in Washington at the time, including about Phil and Catherine Graham, who, of course, were the owners and publishers of the Washington Post, Angleton, whom we've discussed at least in part, and Ben Bradley, who, as Doug observes, was in the employ of the CIA, which he believes was instrumental or helps to explain how the Post was so successful in taking down Nixon after Watergate. I know some of this is based on what you wrote, some of it based on Doug's own research, and of course, some of it is more general knowledge, but I'd be very interested in what you might want to tell us about Ben Bradley and his role here. I mean, it's one more manifestation of the observation of William Colby that the CIA is everyone of any significance in the major media.
Well, the first person who really brought this to our attention was an author by the name of Deborah Davis. She wrote a book in the late 1970s called Catherine the Great, which was a story of Catherine Graham. And in that book, she postulated that Ben Bradley was working for the CIA. Now, when we say working, it wasn't that he was on the CIA payroll, but that, like a lot of journalists during the Cold War era, he did a lot of favors for the agency when they asked him to. And so, Deborah Davis comes out with this information and also reveals the fact that initially, you know, Phil Graham, who was running the Washington Post, was putting CIA journalists on the payroll. He was also involved in Operation Mockingbird, which was, as you know, a way the CIA had infiltrated the media when it needed to move a particular topic or story to their way of thinking and begin to plant that in the culture. So Phil Graham starts to get very upset after the Bay of Pigs, and he's got some other problems as well, but he gets increasingly disenchanted with the CIA, and they realize that they can no longer count on him. Now, with Ben Bradley, let's just go back there for a minute. During the Rosenberg scandal, Ben Bradley was an attaché in Paris, France, and he had been sent by the CIA to review a number of documents about the case, And Deborah Davis was very successful in unearthing a Justice Department document through a FOIA request that clearly shows that Bradley was coming in at the request of the CIA to do this, this, and this, and it's talked about in the document. And so when she published her book in 1979, Bradley and Katharine Graham were so incensed about the book because it also brought up some unanswered questions about Phil Graham's alleged suicide. They had the book shredded. They had enough influence with Bill Janovich at Harcourt, Brace, and Janovich to have the book recalled and shredded.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was just, I mean, listen, Jim, it's only a free press if you own one.
Yeah. Well said, Peter. And of course, when I said him too, I didn't necessarily mean that he was on their payroll, as you observed, but rather that he was collaborating with and coordinating with and performing functions on their behalf, which may well have included, and indeed appear to have been, the disseminating a lot of information that was not, shall we say, strictly true.
Exactly. And of course, Ben Bradley was outraged by Deborah Davis's book. I mean, Deborah Davis tells stories about how Bradley had to go up and down the East Coast convincing people, this was post-Watergate now, because the Post was being knocked off its pedestal by this young upstart journalist, and Bradley had to go up and down the East Coast trying to convince everyone that he had never worked for the CIA, when in fact he had. And this is one of the things that Bob Crowley even, you know, tells Gregory Douglas, that, you know, Bradley is part of the outfit in terms of they have a lot of influence over him. Of course, Bradley hates to hear these kinds of things. So when Mary Meyer is assassinated, you know, I don't think Bradley was, you know, in the inner sanctum of what was actually going on until afterwards. I don't think he knew that the CIA had taken out Mary initially. But I think subsequently he knew much more than he let on. And that is the thrust of my story about Bradley in the book, which, of course, I know Ben Bradley quite well. I was the only person he allowed to talk to him about Mary Meyer for the last 25 years. And of course, the way I was able to get to him is that he brought my father into this. He goes into the fact in his 1995 memoir that it's my father, Wister Janney, who calls him on the day of the murder and says, "Ben, are you listening to the radio?" And Ben said, "Why would I be listening to the radio, Wister? I'm at work." He said, "Well, there's been a murder on the towpath, and by the sound of the description, it sounds like it could be Mary. Do you know where Mary is?" I mean, it's so obvious what's going on. But, of course, it's not obvious to Bradley, who's not the brightest bulb in the room, you know, I've decided. He's ruthless, but he's not terribly smart.
Perfect to be manipulated by the agency. Peter, we'll take our final break. This is Jim Fester, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special, even extraordinary guest today, Peter Janney, author of Mary's Mosaic, Will D. Fester, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation with Peter Janney. Peter, you know, I'll bet a lot of our listeners are astonished to have heard that JFK actually enrolled at Princeton before he took some time out and then transferred to Harvard. I mean, you know, he would have been one of our most distinguished alumni.
he most definitely would have been. You know, I think probably his father wanted him to go to Harvard initially, but there was probably a little rebellious streak with Jack when he was at Choate. And, of course, a lot of his roommates and people he knew at Choate were going to Princeton. And, you know, I think he felt he'd just be more comfortable there, at least initially. And I think he would have ended up finishing there had he not been, you know, infirmed with these various infirmities that he had during that time.
Now, Peter, you appear to me have written this very rich and complex and subtle analysis of a very important period in the life of someone we all, or most of us, vastly admired. I'd like, in this final segment, for you to give us an overview of what your research has instructed, what you have learned from it about American political society and the role of the CIA therein, and what eventually any of us might or might not be able to do about it?
Well, I wish I could give a cogent answer to that, Jim, in 100 words or less. When I finished this book, I was overjoyed to be finished because it was an immense challenge for me to get done. But I was also deeply saddened, and I talk about this in the epilogue of the book of, where I finally finished my research and I'm putting this all together.
Well, Peter, you had to have been emotionally drained. I mean, this involved people you knew personally.
Well, not only that, a couple of points during, the writing, I so wanted to quit, and I was just smart enough that I just took my little fanny back into psychotherapy for a while and said, I need help. I've got to work something out here in order to get this done. And fortunately, I found a colleague of mine who put me in touch with a woman psychotherapist who is just so incredibly helpful to me, and that's really one of the things that allowed me to, push through the resistance that I had. But the bigger panorama here, Jim, is that we are all left in this position of being a citizen in a participatory democracy. And what
we would like to believe is a participatory democracy.
Exactly, and yet we must, as citizens, gain control of or regain control of our country. Our country has been stolen from us. We no longer own our country. We are no longer democratically in charge of our country. It's being run by the national security apparatus, it's being run by bankers, it's being run by the pharmaceutical industry and all the financial interests that are honing their sights on us.
Just to reflect how far that goes, Peter, it appears that 9/11 even itself was a national security event that was staged by the CIA in collusion with the Pentagon in order to instill fear into the American people in order to manipulate us, for them to promote their political agenda, which included a transformation of American foreign policy, of never having attacked any nation that hadn't attacked us first, in order to launch these wars of aggression into Afghanistan, Iraq, now using NATO, taking out Libya too. Who knows what's going to happen with Syria? Talk about attacking Iran is so insane, I can hardly believe any politician has stood up for it. And yet we have had a succession of candidates on the Republican side who virtually the first words out of their mouth when they would do these public debates was to announce that they were the most dedicated to a first strike on Iran, a country that hasn't attacked any other country for 300 years.
Exactly. And this sort of speaks to, a sense of futility that can really begin to cover all of our lives, and we throw up our hands in disgust and say, well, what can I do? And this is where I really feel that people have got to step out of their little world of ignorance and get educated about what's going on. I mean, not only did Richard Nixon, during his tenure as president, end the draft, thereby making sure that smart college kids who might question what American imperialism was doing might be able to, like they had in Vietnam, really throw a wrench into that conflict. But he started to, in a sense, undermine our whole educational system. And look at us today. Look at what has happened since the 1970s, at the last 40 years, to our educational system. It's gone into the toilet.
It has, and I love your point about the draft. I have many times explained why. One of the principles I advocate for regaining some control over democracy includes eliminating or abolishing the use of electronic voting machines, which make it effortless to steal elections. Making all elections for federal office publicly financed to get private money out getting the lobbyists out of the process of writing legislation in Washington, D.C., as though that could ever take place, but where the Israeli lobby's influence over our foreign policy has been devastating for nearly 50 years now. And then finally, restoring the draft, because it's by virtue of having your own sons and daughters potentially liable to death or harm that the American people care about these decisions of whether to go to war or not, and that it seems to me that by privatizing the military in essence, but restricting it to a certain segment of society where the middle class and upper class don't have anything to fear, we have lost control over that vital decision-making aspect of warfare.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's absolutely essential that the military draft be reinstituted, you know, and I think that is possibly one of the first lessons of a democracy. You know, were that to be the case today, we would be in a far different place in so many different ways. I just am completely convinced of that.
But Charlie Rangel took a lot of heat for that, but he's one of the few astute Democrats who really realize why it's indispensable to a functioning democracy to have everyone involved
absolutely
in decisions of war and peace, and not merely to delegate it to Congress, which then delegates it to the executive branch of the government and allows presidents to decide whether we go to war or not.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's just absolutely essential. But
Peter, it had to be devastating to grow in your knowledge about the role of Richard Helms and James Jesus Angleton and Cord Meyer and even your own father, and then Mary Meyer, someone whom you had adored as a young man and who meant so much to you personally, to be confronted with the revelations one after another that were taking place as you burrowed deeper and deeper and deeper into the story behind her death.
Well, it certainly did. And of course, that didn't happen in one fell swoop. I mean, when I entered college in the fall of 1966, I went through a real academic transformation in terms of what I was exposed to. And of course, during that time was the acceleration of the Vietnam War, and I decided to make it my business to know what the hell was going on. And it was during my tenure as an undergraduate at Princeton that this intellectual awakening took place, where I really began to get very upset, not only at America's incursion into Southeast Asia, but to really come to some understanding of what the CIA and my father were actually doing in the world. And of course, this is when my relationship with my father, and in large part my mother as well, really went through rupture after rupture after rupture. And of course, my father died with our relationship never being really reconciled. But so I was forced, it was sink or swim. I had to grow up fast. I had to become an adult a lot faster than I would have liked to. And it wasn't easy. It was sometimes traumatic. But, you know, there were a lot of people like myself who were going through something similar. And this was part of the awakening that the 1960s and the Cultural Revolution during the 60s gave all of us. I think it was an incredible time to be alive and to be at that age and be alive and to really begin to be opened to a greater truth that was taking place. And it has everything to do with assuming a certain responsibility about being a citizen in a purported democracy. And I think each of us have to come to our own position with regard to that in terms of how can I be a good citizen and make sure that my country is living up to the ideals upon which it was founded.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. Harry Truman said the greatest mistake he ever made was creating the Central Intelligence Agency. I don't think any serious historian today could disagree with that assessment.
I take that up in my book, Jim.
I mean, it's a cancer that's involved the entire country. It's metastasized, Peter. We are in the throes of a wrenching destruction and death of democracy at the hands of the CIA, the NSA, and the other intelligence agencies of the United States.
Well, we don't know the real truth of our country. We don't have access to the real historical truth of what happened. I mean, at least one third or more of Cold War history has been kept from us. There are so many things, I'm convinced, that we don't know the actual historical truth about. And this is being done intentionally. And until we can get the last 50,000 pages in the National Archives about the Kennedy assassination released, to say nothing of all the files that are in the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of Naval Intelligence, and the CIA does not destroy anything. I believe the MK Ultra files are still there, even though Richard Helms said he ordered the destruction of them. People I know who worked inside the agency have said to me, off the record, of course, the CIA never destroys anything.
Yeah, that's because it has to know the truth in order to deceive others about what actually happened, who was where, when they were there, and what actually went down.
Exactly.
I mean, they have to know the truth.
Exactly. I guess if you work for the CIA, ironically, you get to know the real historical truth.
You know the truth so you can lie about it and deceive the American people. Isn't that an irony?
Yeah, I mean, I'm laughing, but it's tragic.
See, something really important about your book, Peter, is you talk actually about, you know, you use this historic case to illustrate their methods and techniques. In fact, I have no doubt whatsoever that that's what has most troubled the agency about your book. And mark my words, they are very familiar with it. They probably bought the first 100 copies off of the press. And it's finished to the highest echelon members of the agency. I kid you not.
Well, you know, CNN invited me on Kira Phillips' program back in April, about a month ago, and of course it was an ambush. I mean, I couldn't even get a word in. They read a statement from the CIA. They had some stooge from Boston University who pretended to be a historian saying that I was wrong about this and I was wrong about that. And the interview was over before I could even get an opportunity to reply.
Yeah, it's a parallel with the ninth segment of The Men Who Killed Kennedy, the masterful series, you know, produced by Nigel Turner, the brilliant British producer.
Yeah.
That laid out a whole lot of evidence that implicated Lyndon Johnson as the pivotal player in the assassination. And the History Channel was pilloried for that, you know, Bill Moyers, Ladybird attacks, and so on and so on. They had to withdraw it. So they finally had this kind of apologetic forum where they had three historians.
I recorded that actual segment. I still have
it. One of them was an historian of constitutional law from Wisconsin here, where I live in Madison, who didn't know anything about the assassination. Another was a guy who was an historian of urban sociology from Penn. And then they had Robert Dalek, who is a bona fide historian, but vastly ignorant about the assassination. It was ridiculous. They all said this was inconceivable. They didn't offer one iota of evidence to contradict anything that had been established by Nigel Turner during his segment.
And not only that, Robert Dalek said, well, people should go out and read Gerald Posner's book.
How absurd. How absurd. I mean, if there's a more notorious book that gives a false story of the assassination, it's Posner's Case Closed. I mean, this is ridiculous. If anyone goes to Assassination Science and scroll down the menu bar, they'll find an article entitled Posner's Fallacy. Well, I took one page out of Case Closed, and I found 10 different factual mistakes or intellectual blunders about the man Mr. Carcano alone. 10 blunders. I subtitled it Taking a Page from Posner. Ridiculous.
Jim, I have to handle, I mean, you have been a one-man wrecking crew in terms of putting yourself out there with some of the best research that I have personally seen in the last 49 years, and I want to commend you for all the things that you have brought together. I think it's magnificent, And I just wish more of the public of this country would lend themselves to really being objective and to being open and to being concerned with factual evidence rather than the kind of crap that we get fed or this culture gets fed from the media and the media hypes who are running this show.
Well, I'll just say, Peter, those are kind words. You have to have the height of a rhinoceros. You have to have, you know, a keen intellect and research capability such as both of us acquired at Princeton, and then you have to have a certain degree of controlled or disciplined aggression such as I acquired during 4 years as a commissioned officer in the Marine Corps. That combination can take you a long way.
Well, it clearly has in your case, Jim, and I want to just say, you know, that we as a educated, those of us in what I would call the educated public owe you a real debt of gratitude for all the fine work that you have done in this arena, and I personally just want to say thank you.
Well, I truly appreciate that, Peter, especially when you've written a brilliant book like this, and I'm already anticipating having you back so we can discuss all of this in greater detail, but I think that you may have done something quite extraordinary here because the approach that you have adopted makes it very easy, even for a housewife who's not intrinsically interested in the assassination per se, to acquire an interest in JFK's romantic involvement with Mary Myers, which made such a difference to him personally, and where in the process of explaining this involvement, this emotional tour de force between them, you expose so much of the machinations of the secret agencies that really control our government, all the duplicity, fakery, and fraud that goes into managing the information that we receive, that I really truly believe this is a breakthrough book in terms of making crucial information that people would prefer to deny or not really know more about accessible to the American public. I think you've done a brilliant job.
Well, I very much hope that people can approach my book from that point of view, you know, because I do think I specifically took probably 2 or 3 years longer than I should have or could have, because I wanted to write not only a compelling story that was immensely readable, but something that was well researched for the people that really needed to understand what good research is and what it can tell us as a country, as a society, as a culture, that it's critically important, you know, that our storytelling from one generation to the next, our history, be imparted with the greatest level of truth. Otherwise, as a country and as a planet, we are doomed to keep spinning our wheels in sand, making the same mistakes over and over again. Meanwhile, our environment and our ecology is being flushed down the toilet, gradually making life uninhabitable on this planet, which would be the greatest tragedy of all.
Peter, somewhere between Fallujah, the BP disaster, and the Gulf, which may in fact have been deliberately planned, and Fukushima, which poses the greatest threat of all, the planet faces the probable contamination of our entire environment, which may lead to the premature death not only of vast numbers, but actually even potentially threatens the survival of the human species. It's terrible to say. I have done too many interviews, too much research on this not to know, however, that it appears to be the truth.
Well, I think that's, you know, it's unfortunate. But Jim, I think we have to face it, and we have to face whatever it is, because I do believe in hope. I do believe there is still hope. I do believe that it is possible to turn this around, but it's going to take a tremendous human will that's really willing to see the truth, accept it, and embrace it, and be determined not to ever make the same mistakes again.
And I cannot accept those kind words about my work without acknowledging that it is because I have had the privilege of working with the best qualified individuals to ever study the case, including Robert Livingston, MD, a world authority on the human brain, an expert on wound ballistics, David W. Mandick, PhD, MD, who I consider to be the leading authority on the assassination in the world today, Jack White, a legendary photo analyst and student of the assassination, Charles Crenshaw, MD, was actually present when JFK was brought into trauma room number one, and 2 days later was responsible for the treatment of Lee Oswald, his accused assassin. John P. Costella, a PhD, has made a massively important contribution to the study of the Zapruder film. And Douglas Horn, who has, as the senior analyst for military records of the ARRB, published a five-volume masterpiece inside the ARRB, where I've been particularly struck, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Peter, how their reviews of your book are so favorable, Doug's in particular is so thorough, that I really have no doubt at all what we had here, which in my opinion appears to me to be that you have written in Mary's Mosaic a masterpiece that is going to be very well received and I believe potentially has the capacity to make a difference to our understanding of American history.
Thank you very much, Jim. That's a wonderful applause to my effort. And, you know, I am going to continue as an author and as a speaker to keep, particularly in the next year and a half, as we come into the 50th anniversary of the assassination, to, you know, really impress upon as many segments of our country as I possibly can.
Peter, I wish you well in that, and I cannot thank you enough for being here on the show. So for now, until next time, because I am looking forward already to having Peter back, special thanks to my guest, Peter Janney, and to all of you out there for listening.
Great to be with you, Jim. Thanks.